Our next speaker is George Blood again, and his topic is You Know You Want It, an introduction to quality control, assurance, and testing. George.
There's an oft-told tale, which Edward Deming's works hard to refute, that after the Second World War and the Allies had bombed Japan back to the Pleistocenes, that the Americans then went in and taught the Japanese how to manufacture quality products, and they then turned around and sent Toyota and Sony to beat us up. The story is, of course, far more nuanced than that because, of course, Deming was preaching those same practices here in the States. Edward Deming is one of my heroes, and I highly recommend, you can just look up lots of his work online. The first chapter of this is required reading among my staff, something they endure their first week. The rest of the book is a bit of a slog, 200 pages in, you're working your way through shoeing charts and such. But if you're just in diving into this topic in any depth, this is where I would point you. There's a website for it. There's a link to a 30,000 foot view of the teachings of Edward Deming and his 14 points. And to summarize a couple of the very key ones, that the errors are rarely the result of employees not trying, that if there's a problem, it's not because somebody's just sloughing off. And very critically, that most errors are controllable if you can think about them in a systematic way. And another very important point to master is this notion of what is difference between special variation and normal variation. What are the kinds of differences that you would expect to encounter in a system versus the outliers? And finally, I'd like to make a real point here is that like preservation, like sound recording, there's an entire profession devoted to this, and we would benefit greatly by reaching out, much as we did to the higher energy particle physics lab at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory that brought us Irene, into these other communities and learn something from them. I want to define these three terms so we can draw a very clear distinction between quality assurance, quality control, and quality testing. If we go to the site of the American Society for Quality, and they make the point that these two terms are often used interchangeably when within the profession of quality, they have very different meanings. Assurance being the act of giving confidence, the state of being certain, or of the act of making certain, as opposed to control. An evaluation to indicate needed corrective responses. So let's look at these a little bit more detail. And then we have quality testing. Within AV, the AV domain, there are a variety of software packages that you can get. Intera Systems Baton or Beton is used by the Library of Congress and Culpeper at the National Archives. Popular product. This is actually kind of a nice one in the interface and the interaction with that. Clover Systems builds testers that not only give you the block error rate error detection, but also give you the distribution of the errors in the error correction process. And we see here these big red marks here helping us to interpret this. But you can go into the preferences and set the thresholds by which it turns from green to yellow to red. And then being able to interpret these outputs of the tests is critically important because depending on the application that you have for this disk, it may or may not be a problem. Because if you're just using this for general access, this disk, if you can read that chart, plays back completely error-free, that the error correction is sufficiently robust to 100% reproduce this disk accurately. However, if you have a collection or that's come to you, that is using CDs for preservation, which was common for a stretch of time, or if you have a bazillion image files sitting on gold CDs, you would be able to look at that data, interpret that, well, the disk is okay now, but we can tell from this that it's not going to be good for very much longer. This is one of the screens from the evolving tool coming out of BayVac, the handiwork of David Rice, QC tools, and you know, out of the box, I don't know too many people who would really be able to read and interpret that. That in some places we've got these great big excursions, right? It's jumping all over the place, and they've got great big spikes here and little ones here. Which ones are important, and what are they telling us in this data? The SAMA systems by Front Porch, now owned by Oracle, this is testing the same data. The charts are very different. What can we do when we receive this data? Because these are the test reports that are coming out. Leaving aside for a moment the philosophical problem that SAMA is grading its own papers, this is not what you would receive. You would just receive a blizzard of of XML. So when you get this test report, this QC report from the output of a SAMA system, what can you do with that information? That there's an important distinction that quality testing is neither quality assurance nor quality control, that the delivery of a quality test report is not evidence of quality control, it's just the testing. So we want to be sure that we understand what it is that we're receiving from all of these different methods. This one struck me in my research to being kind of interesting. This is from Digimetrics, that this tool has better correction, that the tool can find errors and fix them for you. Isn't this a bit like, you know, taking your interstitial errors and using dclick to remove them? I'm not sure that going through the data and post-processing it so that it then becomes legal and you don't have digital overs anymore constitutes quality control, much less more trust in our digital files. Moving on into the domain of, or going back to Edward Deming, I'm going to work through some of these points that he's raising and ways that you can build a quality system. What we want first and foremost is to be clear that the system is working properly or working correctly. And how would we know that? Well, you test it. And we want to be sure that the equipment is operating properly and it's operating to manufacturer specifications. We wouldn't expect to get 20 kilohertz off a cylinder. That's not within specifications. The machine may be working properly, or according to industry standards for whatever they may be, regards to, you know, jitter in an A to D converter, or what a reference level may be for what zero equals in an analog machine. And we have a variety of tools for this in test patterns and alignment tapes that we can use for testing our equipment to be sure that they're working. This is one of the things that Nick was talking about this morning, is creating reference standard cylinders. And that very critically, the results are repeatable. You put an alignment tape up on a quarter inch machine, and every time you do that, the results are the same. This is quality assurance. The act of making something work properly, making something quality. And we would like to know that our system's output is correct. Well, how would you know? Well, this is not surprisingly, with testing. That the output matches, perhaps in this case, the project specifications. And we'll look at some of those examples. And those specifications may be to industry standards that we want to say that we can conform to TC04 in whatever way that might be. Although we've had projects that the specification was for 48K 24-bit mono. That is the project specifications. And that the processed sources yield the anticipated results at output. that you put a tape up and you're expecting a stereo tape and you get a stereo playback. And again, that the results are repeatable, that if the equipment is functioning properly, then every time you play back that tape within the variability of analog reproduction, you get the same results each time. This constitutes quality control, because if at any point you're not getting what the output is anticipated to be, you've got an error, and you need to then reassure your system by making corrections to it. The act of quality control. In the identification between normal variation and special variation, well, we're gathering samples in our tests. And if we were to take an example of, we're digitizing periodicals, and it's a monthly publication, and we're expecting 12 issues in a year, and we receive 11, is that supposed to be that way? This is an indication of an error. We're not getting the anticipated output. We need to investigate why that may be the case. Because if we were instead doing weekly publications, and you know, Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report, then we would expect 52 issues. But if one of your publications that you're digitizing is The Economist magazine, well, they only publish 51 times a year. At the end of the year, it's a double issue. If we're digitizing broadcast programs, especially syndicated programs, we would expect all of them to be exactly the same length. Those of us who work in broadcasting become familiar with the NPR hour, that at the top of the hour, they give you the news, and around the clock, there are different designated breaks, and that if you were doing NPR programs, that you would expect them all to come in within a fraction of a few seconds, and that would be highly repeatable. Do we expect our masters and proxies to be equal duration? Well, at first blush, yes, but if, being audio people, we're digitizing tapes that are Dolby encoded, we might reasonably include the Dolby tone on our masters. But do we want to present our users, the first thing they hear is the Dolby tone? That'll be fun under headphones. Or do we include the Dolby tones because we want to let the user know that that's available in the master file? What is the anticipated outcome so that we can know what is correct? And anything that would be outside that normal range is special and therefore needs to be investigated. We could look at this from a survey or collection standpoint, where we know that if you take a random collection of audio materials, greater than 90 or 95% of those materials are going to be audio cassettes, quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape, and discs. Those are normal things, and things like phonautograms and Protana wires are special variation within our sample sets. So you can think of this as baseline information for the consistency within a system, and that anything outside of that is special variation. And this is the point at which we find most quality control systems, the feedback that we're getting in the collections that we're working with, this is where it breaks down. Because quality control is not about checking whether something is correct. Quality control is inherently, to quote the American Society for Quality, an evaluation to indicate corrective responses. So if for some reason your specifications are 96.16, and I'm sending you batches of files that are 96.24, but you haven't gotten around to QAing those yet, we could get all the way to the end of the project with 96.24 files that are not according to specification, not as expected, but that's not quality control, because the point of quality control is that it feeds back into corrective action into the system. You look for where the error is coming from, in this case, an error in the specification, to find the cause and to correct for it. Very important point, that that for quality control to be effective in a system, it must come very, very quickly. And in an automobile manufacturing plant, you know, when it rolls out of the factory, all the quality control is done. It's because it's divided into different parts along the production chain, but it's being done within minutes of the quality control. Quality control that happens weeks later makes rework rather than a control of a system. Even though it's late in the afternoon, I'm sure everybody noticed that I had left number one off this, because although it's the most important one, I'm going to save it at the end to discuss it, is that we have this fundamental problem of how we define quality. So I'm going to spend probably the rest of my time on this issue of defining quality. If we think of this in terms of scanning, of course, we want the images to look good, right? We want the sound that we get back from digitization, we want it to sound good. Well, here we have two good-looking women. And you would think that based on this, that Renoir and Versace were from, you know, Mars and Venus, but this would be an example of they're both good-looking images. What's wrong with the specification? And fundamentally, the issue is that qualitative parameters make for poor quality control, that we need parameters that are more finite, so that when we say that we want it to be right, we have to define what right is. How about Mr. Right? Okay, we can find Mr. Right here, some good-looking gent with, you know, this Don Johnson 4 days of stubble. I mean, he's comfortable in jewelry, obviously, this nice thing hanging around his sternum, and he's comfortable in rings, and he, you know, very fashionable with stretch fabric below the waist. Two very eligible men in their own age, I suppose. So we could write lots of specifications for an image like this, and if anybody's ever tried to find a random image from searches on the internet, you can never quite find what you want, because, you know, you're trying to define something that's pretty intangible. And so in defining quality, we have to break this into smaller pieces such that we define what it is that we're trying to control. And after you've defined what is it that you're trying to control, how are you going to measure it? How do we define what correct is? And that even that correct may need to be within a certain range of tolerance, and within that tolerance, we may encounter special variations, and those special variations may in turn be errors, or they may be correct. But by definition, a special variation is where there is is where the errors live. And then, having discovered that error, what do you do about it? So, most common causes of failure, as I said earlier, are not because the employees are not working hard or giving it their all. It's that systems aren't functioning correctly, that the result of poor quality assurance at some point along the continuum from conception to output. These are often the result of unclear specifications. And as we define a problem in greater detail to the point where the qualitative elements become quantifiable, there may actually be a very large number of parameters that we're looking at. And each of those are a chance for the specifications or expectations to be unclear. And where errors are associated with individuals, it's usually the result of a problem of training. Are they trained to do the task? Do they have enough experience? Are they able to read the specifications? Are they understood? And very much so, the sooner those errors are identified, then the system can be adjusted, and then fewer errors will be made. And that, again, this very rapid feedback loop in QC is absolutely imperative. So to summarize at this point, catch up a little bit for our thoughts, we have quality testing, which is the means by which we can establish assurance that our system is functioning in a quality way. And given clear specifications and accurate processes and tools, we can perform quality control because we have defined what it is that we're controlling and feedback into the system. To control for those errors. So to use an example, what do we want to control? In our audio files, we want we want the resolution. We'd like to use, say, Jove. There are other tools that you could use, even within software. Any software will tell you, you know, what the resolution of your files is. I chose Jove as a third party because it doesn't create files, it just probes them, and it's got very tight adherence to the file specifications. And we define that we want it to be 96/24 and the tolerance is zero, that if we're delivering 96/23 or 96/20-bit files, that's an error. However, we could very easily drill down far more deeply and look at the linearity of the 24 bits within the A to D converter, or how much jitter is acceptable within that 96 kilohertz, and what kind of accuracy we're looking for in our jitter specification. But at the highest level, just looking at what we want for resolution of the files, they shall be 96/24, and then in this box of tapes, you've got a couple of CDs. What do we do with those CDs? The specification says the output shall be 96/24. Do we normalize the 4416 CDs to 96/24 because that's what the specification is? Or is there an exception for this special variation where we have born digital elements are retain their born digital attributes? So it's a refinement to the specification. And some of these things we can anticipate, and others we can't. So we come back, you're transferring a whole bunch of CD audio discs to find that some of them are CD-ROMs or even, and then they have audio files on them. What do we do with the audio files? Or what do you do if you encounter a DVD in an audio collection that has audio on it? So this question then is, what is special variation? We change the specification to define 96/24 unless that it's a born digital and we keep it in its native format. We have an evolution of our standard, and now there's not an error. And it's not an error because we changed anything other than we made clear what our specifications are. The specification is what changed within our system to make it correct. So if other than CDs, if we're not getting 96/24, why might that be the case? Well, we can simply go back and check the settings on the A to D converter. It can be that simple. But if you're running 24 hours a day and you have materials coming out over a large project and that A to D converter is set long and you're not doing your QA until weeks later, you can't take corrective action. It doesn't become quality control, it becomes rework. You may confirm that the employee knows how to read the specifications. This is a training issue. This isn't because somebody's sitting there, playing on the internet. It's just because there's an inadequacy of training and so on. Let's take another example, headroom. What's a permissible amount of headroom? We know that we don't want the files to clip, so what is correct? It shall be less than 0 dBFS. It shall be less than full scale. But what's tolerance? Do we want all of our files to be at minus 0.1? How achievable is that? You're writing a specification that is not achievable within any practical realm because either you're going to do something naughty like normalize the files, or you have to play the tapes multiple times to reach that, in which case your output collapses, and how much value add is there in doing this? So if we define that there's 12 dB of headroom is acceptable, what do we do about record clicks? Do we allow the record clicks to clip so that we can get a much higher average level from our files, or do we keep the level lower, thereby increasing the distortion and lowering the signal to noise of the entire file so that we leave 20 dB of headroom for the clicks to be captured cleanly? We're not going to answer this question today, and there's more than one correct answer to this, but you need to define what your parameters are, what your tolerance is, and the basis of that so that you can design a system and then verify what is correct in your system. And again, it's the same process of investigate the settings. If you're clipping your tape files all the time, the input settings are set wrong. Is there something wrong with one of the op amps in the signal chain that periodically is losing a rail and suddenly you've got a whole bunch of gain for a few seconds in a file, some piece of equipment isn't operating properly? Review your specifications. How did we define? I remember we had this discussion about record clips. Did we decide what it is that we were going to do about it, or did we just talk about it? And so on throughout the entire process. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to see if we can wake everybody up. And I have, here we go, I have a spreadsheet. La-di-da. And we're going to have some audience participation. I'll go away. Zoom, make sure to make this appear on the screen. All right, I'm gonna leave that where it is. Can you see this well enough? So I have in the spreadsheet the two examples that I've already given. What do you want to control? How are you going to measure it? What's correct? What's the tolerance? What's normal versus special variation? And what corrective action do we take? Anybody? What was a parameter that we might want to check within our systems? What is something that we need to check? That's the headrooms up there. Huh? We can check, so we get headroom. We can use a tool like FFProbe, Snapper, the global analysis tool, lots of tools available to do this. We want it to be less than full scale. We don't want any overs. We're gonna define 12 dB as the peak value. And we need to deal with these special variations of record clips, record clicks, and how we want to deal with that. And we may want to refine the specification that record clicks may clip for up to 3 milliseconds. There are many people in here, I'm sure, will disagree with this, but this is just, we're writing a specification, and I'm just trying to provide some examples. How about, here we go, shipping. Materials are being shipped. What do we want about the shipping? Well, we can test it by, how about delivery time? What's correct? What would be correct in shipping? How about, travels on weekdays so that the materials don't sit in a warehouse or in the back of a truck over a weekend? The tolerance? 3 p.m. Friday afternoon. What's normal and special variation? Well, depending on where you are, the date it's shipping, its normal variation is ground, but if you're shipping late in the week, you'll do it express. And if it doesn't get there, what's the corrective what corrective action do we take? Depends on what the cause of the problem is. The most likely cause is that the person who's doing the shipping is either unaware or isn't reading the specifications deeply enough to look at why, when, what the expectation is for the corrective action. So I would say review specifications with shipping folk. What other kinds of things might we want to check in a quality control environment? That would be in a quality assurance parameter, because it's hard to measure wow and flutter in a playback. But that's quality assurance, not quality control. You would test the system to be sure that it's operating properly. We could do that. So WoW and Flutter as a quality control example. How do we measure it? How about an audio precision test set, huh? Fixity. Let's move on to that. Bit accuracy, so we'll redefine Steve's question as we want to be sure that all the bits arrive there accurately. And the parameter here is, how would we measure this? Well, with a hash value. What's the tolerance? 0. What is correct? Match. Tolerance, 0. Your checksum matches or it doesn't. There is none. There is no special variation in checksums. Where might a checksum go wrong? Well, there's no human error associated with this unless it's the wrong type. Cable? Drive failure? These are all going to be hardware problems. No, it wouldn't be an A to D converter. How about the checksum being out of date? That you went and modified the metadata. It'll certainly show up in the number. But what corrective action do you take for that? Where would you go look for where an error like that had crept into your system? This is a good. Okay. What's something else that you would like to be correct about your files? File names. Okay, so you get file names. How do we measure that? How about a text string? Okay. What would be correct? That it matches the specification, matches the file naming convention as it was specified. I would think the tolerance is zero. Let me ask you a question about file names. Say you're doing audio cassettes. Most of the audio cassettes have two sides. We'd want to define whether it's we define the sides as 1, 2, or 01, or 02, or underscore 01, or 02, or A, or B. What if it has only an A side? And we're designating them A and B. If we define it as, we want to be sure that it's side A, so we say Nicholas A to define it. Does that imply that there is a B? Does the presence of a side indicator imply that there's a B side? So we define then that if it's just one-sided, we say Nicholas and it doesn't have a suffix, then it looks wrong. All right, this is another variation Steve brings up, that if we're going to deliver side B and there's no information on side B, then we need to define also that we're delivering blank sides. So B blank and non-delivered. If we're going to have the A and on there, which implies that there would be a B, then we have somewhere in our provenance data that side B is blank. So our specification about a file name has grown into how do we deal with this variation of the B side, and when the B side is blank, we need to accommodate this in our provenance metadata. So we now have two specifications measuring this. Mr. Klinger, this is a domain that I'm sure you understand. So we're trying to build a quality control system, and we're looking for examples of things in audio preservation that we would want to check in our quality control system to verify, when we're looking at what that specification is, how we measure it, what's tolerance, and what we do about it. And we have a couple of examples that we've been building here. I'm asking you because you have a professional experience in this matter.
And what's the question?
Just give us an example. Yes. No, of quality control.
Mostly it's a matter of metrology and measurement.
Well, give us an example that we're going to measure.
If you're producing a widget that's got to be 1 foot long, you might want to measure it to make sure it's a foot long, but more importantly, make sure the process that cuts it to a foot long will cut it to a foot within a tenth of an inch or whatever the tolerance.
Oh, so we have tolerance, we have a measurement, we have a means of measuring it. I have a sense that a member of the choir has entered the room. Anybody else want to take a stab at this? Michael. Playback speed? Do we want to narrow this down between formats? Okay, so playback speed in open real tape and our output formats, how do we measure whether we have the accurate playback speed? You must listen. What constitutes correct? If we hearken back to the early days of first sounds and the phonautograms, and this ghostly voice of a woman singing Frère Jacques, upon further reflection, although it certainly sounded correct, the current thinking is that it may be Martinville Scott himself, that it was a male's voice. So how can we know that it's correct based on the listening to the speed? It's... I've picked an exclusionary case, but certainly in some of the collections, ATM or recording field recordings of animal sounds or ethnographic recordings, we might really struggle to define what a correct speed is in that instance.
So one of the risks, now you can hear me, is that the digitization operator recorded it at the wrong speed and missed it for whatever reasons. In that case, then, what we're looking for is a match between what's in the file and what should, you know, what the correct speed is on the tape.
Either I didn't hear everything you said or I missed your point. That it's just that at the end, it may just be that what we need is that the what's in the file matches what's on the tape.
Yeah, that's actually not quite the right way to think about it as I think about this out loud. But the original tape was played back at the wrong speed and it was missed. So what you have in the file is either slow or fast, depending on how it was played back incorrectly. And so what you need to correct it is human judgment that, hey, this isn't right. This should be reproduced at 7.5 inches per second, not 3.75, for example.
Right. Oh, yeah, Steve's raising it. What happens is if someone happened to have bumped the vary speed during recording, where it's running at 7 instead of 7.5 IPS. These are much harder to detect.
That's another case entirely.
Yeah. Rob, you have some experience in your tools for this. What kinds of things are we quantitatively checking?
I considered what I thought was the original request, which is making sure that the machine was running at the correct speed, and we have calibration tapes that...
That's quality assurance.
Well, you put the tape on the machine and you analyze the tones, and so you know based on a tolerance whether it matches the correct speed.
Well, that's quality assurance that your system's operating properly, but when you then take your archival tape and put it up on there, how do you know that it's playing at the correct speed?
Because you put the calibration tape directly before you put the tape that you're preserving.
And then someone plays it at 3 3/4 instead of 7 1/2.
Yeah, but we're assuming that the employee is always going to do a good job. Isn't that what you said at the beginning?
So, there, as Sarah wraps us up here, there are two points that I would like to have you focus on. One is the significance and importance of quality control and quality review being extremely rapid, very, very quickly after the process, so that you can find those errors and change whatever it is inherent in the process so that the errors do not occur in the first place. It's recidivism we're trying to correct for. And that we all like quality, we all like to build quality control systems, and it requires some thought as to what parameters that we're looking for that constitutes correct, so that when you're asking for this from your vendors or if you're trying to do it in-house, what are you looking for? What parameters are being verified, which can be done automatically in software, and what things, like the example that Michael has, of that require human interaction with.
That's it.
Yes.